You ready, Mr. Bosch? All right, appellant may begin.
Good afternoon. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, number 17497. I'm the ADC appointed counsel for the defendant appellant in this case. And I asked for oral argument because this case presents such a very unusual and bizarre issue. When I was writing the opening brief, I tried to search for any case in any jurisdiction where a sitting judge had actually been seated as a juror in a criminal case. And I couldn't find any cases. And I couldn't find any cases construing Canon 2 regarding the situation of a judge sitting as a juror in any case, civil or criminal. This isn't just a case where we have two judges in this case, and for ease of reference, I'm going to refer to them as Judge P, who was the presiding judge, and Judge G, who was the judge who was seated on the jury, and they were both active judges, both in the same judicial district. It's not just that the other jury members found out that their fellow juror member, Judge G, was a sitting judge. There was this whole banter that went on during the jury selection process where the DA was referring to this prospective juror as judge, highlighting the fact that he was a judge, engaging in discussions with other jury members that this potential jury member was a judge, saying things like, at one point he asked a jury member who was a professor, well, if you were on trial in Judge G's courtroom, what do you think would happen under these circumstances? At one point, another prospective juror's cell phone went off, and the DA said, now, if that happened in Judge G's courtroom, he'd hold you in contempt and throw you in jail. So the DA was elevating the judge to a Judge G to a higher level than just a prospective jury member. And I realize this is a case of first impression, but I respectfully submit that Judge G allowing that to happen, to allow his office of judge to be used in that matter during jury selection, crossed the line and violated Canon 2. And for the public defender to allow that to continue to happen and not shut it down, not object to it, not ask that Judge G be questioned outside the presence of the other jury panel members if there was something that needed to be discussed regarding the fact that Judge G was also a sitting judge in that judicial district, that that was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Counsel, let me ask you this. I fail to see in any respect how Canon 2B is implicated here. I need some further information from you or some other argument to tell me how Judge G allowed his family, social, or other relationships to influence his judicial conduct or judgment in this case, or how he lent the prestige of his office to advance the private interest of others.
It seems that he was lending.
I don't understand it.
Okay, and I realize it doesn't quite fit.
No, I don't think so.
But it seemed that what was happening, he was there in his capacity as a private citizen. And instead, he was allowing himself to be addressed as judge and everybody else to address him as judge. And apparently during jury deliberation, the other jurors were referring to him as judge. And I think that fits within the lending the prestige of his office to advance somebody else's interests, namely either the DA's or the people's interest here in a case in a situation that was inappropriate. And I realize that that's never... there's no case on point because as far as I can tell, something like that's never happened before, where we've had a sitting judge be questioned in front of the other jury members, and the fact that he's a sitting judge be used in that type of manner in front of the other jury members.
What should he have done? Should he have refused to serve on the jury?
No, he should have refused to allow the DA to continue to do that.
How could he have done that? How could Judge G have done that?
By asking Judge P to stop the DA and request that he be questioned outside the presence of the other jury members. I don't know any other way to handle that other than preventing sitting judges from even being qualified as jury members, but the way I'm reading the statute is that they're qualified to sit as jury members. So I guess once in a blue moon, a sitting judge is going to get a summons and his number is going to actually come up.
It's not once in a blue moon, counsel.
It happens more often than that?
It happens pretty often, and judges do sit on juries.
This is the first case I've come across where it was so blatant during jury questioning where the DA was asking the other jury members to put themselves in a position as if they were being tried in his courtroom or being held in contempt by him, for
example. Counsel, let me interrupt you for a minute. I understand that, in your view, the public defender should have done something differently. The prosecutor should have been doing something differently. Both of these judges, in your view, should have been doing something differently. But as I understand your brief, your complaint is a specific comment that Judge G made and its impact on this case. I mean, you're not, as I read your brief, this is not a question that Judge G should never have been seated as a juror, is it?
No. And if in fact all this went on,
prosecutorial misconduct, you're not complaining about prosecutorial misconduct.
No. If all of this had went on, I still would have think it would have been inappropriate. But what happened was it then got carried over into the jury deliberation rooms where the jury members started questioning this jury member who they knew was a judge, what type of sentence would the defendant get? And relying on his expertise as a judge to tell him that. Now, I realize we just have the juror affidavits. The public defender was not able to go and question the other jury members to find out all these other things I wish were in the record, like, was that the only time that came up? Did that just come up in a vacuum? How soon after they all thought they had reached a unanimous verdict did that discussion take place? Had the verdicts already been filled out and signed? Did any other jury members overhear that other than the two jury members referenced in the affidavit? Did those conversations come up at any other time during deliberations? Did Judge G...
Excuse me, minute, counsel. Who has the burden here? Who has the burden? The verdict comes in and the defendant later learns of these things. Who has the burden of showing that because of these things, a fair trial was denied?
Oh, she had the burden, and she did what she was supposed to do. She asked for a hearing on this, and the judge said, I can't consider any of this under 606B. And that ruling, you can review de novo, and that's what I'm saying. The judge was wrong as a matter of law. Clearly, there was juror misconduct here. Clearly, there's an exception to Rule 606B that applies, but now we have to... The case has to be remanded so we can actually have
what
that hearing so the defendant can try to, excuse me, Your Honor?
What exception to 606B applies?
That there was extraneous and prejudicial information that was improperly brought to the jury member's attention, namely what type of sentence the defendant could or should be expected to receive.
Help us out with why that was extraneous information within the meaning of 606B1.
Well, it would be like if one of the jury members had gone home, if the deliberation had gone overnight and looked up on the internet what the sentencing schemes were and then come into the jury member the next day and say, hey, this is a crime of violence. She's automatically going to the DOC. We should consider that. And in this case, instead of doing that, they just asked the judge who was a jury member. And
well, that's a little bit different, isn't it? Because if there was a juror who did that, that juror would be bringing information in from the internet or maybe from a book or maybe from some other resource material, but would not be bringing in. But in this case, that didn't occur. The juror that you're talking about was talking about information based upon his own expertise. Is that right?
Right, and I disagree with the people that in the case of Judge G, that this is just like another juror having some particular expertise, such as in stamp collecting or a certain type of automobile that was involved in an accident in the civil case. Asking a judge what the law is the same thing as going and consulting a law book. That is extraneous, and that is jury misconduct. It's like looking on your cell phone to reference a calendar that you're not supposed to be looking at during deliberations, or bringing in the Bible to read Bible passages other than some of the jury members maybe quoting Bible passages from memory. To me, that's the exact same thing as if they had brought in the law book or downloaded something from the internet. So that's why I'm saying that's extraneous, and that's why I'm saying there was an exception to 606B, and therefore there has to be a remand so that the six factors set forth in the Harlan test can be fleshed out, and the defendant has a chance to meet her burden of proof on the facts now that an objective juror in these positions would have been prejudiced by that extraneous material, by kind of being lulled into thinking that the defendant would receive a sentence to probation. Because not only did Judge G talk about the law, but he was specifically instructed and he promised to take the law from Judge P and not discuss that during jury deliberations, but he got it wrong. So he misled the other jury members who were asking him about this particular point.
What was the evidence about the timing of that comment? It would seem to me, am I wrong that if the jurors voted before that happened, that it would be more difficult then to conclude that that prejudiced your client?
I agree it's more difficult, but I think she should have a chance at a hearing to be able to flesh out the facts. The public defender couldn't even contact these other jury members and ask them about what this jury member was saying about what Judge G was talking about during deliberations. The DA asked that she be referred to the Office of the Regulation Council for even accepting this affidavit from juror number three. So she would have been in a whole lot more trouble if she had tried to go out and collect more facts. That's why we need to have a hearing. Were the verdicts already filled out and signed and they were just headed out the door engaging in idle chit-chat, or was it possible that one of them could have changed their mind, or was that a continuation of a conversation that had started earlier? We don't know that without a hearing.
I thought there was something in one of the briefs of the record, and I can't remember for sure now, maybe you can refresh my memory, that was the case, that the juror's affidavit who reported this made some indication that the jurors had voted. They had voted to find the defendant guilty, and after that occurred, one of the jurors supposedly asked Judge G what he thought the sentence would be.
Right, that's what juror number three said in his affidavit, which is at page 76 of volume one. You know, under the six-part Harlan test, whether or not the erroneous and extraneous information is brought to the attention of the jury before or after the verdict is only one factor to consider. It's not dispositive, but I respectfully submit that the defendant needs the opportunity to have a hearing to be sure that this wasn't a continuation of a conversation that happened between other jury members prior to the verdict, and at what point. Yes, juror number three says he thought that everybody had decided, but they hadn't left the jury room yet. We don't know even whether the verdict forms have been filled out and signed at that point. And until the verdict is announced in open court, there isn't a verdict. I mean, the jury can change their mind. So I think the defendant needs the opportunity to have a hearing that she certainly has a prima facie case here, but she needs the opportunity to have a hearing to question these jury members on this specific issue, not on their deliberations in general, to find out, to be able to put Judge G's remarks to these two jury members into a better context. I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris Bosk, attorney registration number 39036, representing the people in this matter. With respect to the first issue, the defendant claims that the trial court erred in failing or refusing to consider the juror affidavit. I think it's really important to consider the language of the affidavit. And if it please the court, I'll read the pertinent part of it now. The judge on the jury was asked by someone, after we decided on the verdict, but still in the jury room, if he knew what sentence the defendant would receive. And he responded that he thought she would receive a particular sentence. Under 606B, which strongly disfavors juror testimony impeaching a verdict, that rule says a juror may not testify as to any matter or statement occurring during the course of the jury's deliberations. Now, despite the fact that the jury had already reached their verdict, and that's clear from the affidavit, they were still sitting in the jury room, and there's a hypothetical possibility that they could have revisited issues, that they could have changed their mind. So to that extent, I agree that deliberations were still occurring. And because of that, the trial court properly declined to consider the affidavit. They were still in deliberation. So that's just a threshold matter. But even if we want to take this to the next step of the analysis, we have to ask whether the statement was extraneous, because 606B makes an exception and allows a juror to testify about extraneous prejudicial, information improperly brought to the juror's attention. So the argument here is that the information about potential sentencing was extraneous prejudicial information. I'd submit that it's neither. It's not extraneous information. There's no case law in Colorado that would support that proposition. In fact, the cases that address extraneous information would suggest just the opposite. Separate divisions of this court have addressed numerous cases about extraneous information. They deal with things like a jury foreman that goes out to a bar and asks questions about a gun that was used by the defendant, or a juror that conducts an independent investigation outside of the jury room about the feasibility of a defendant being at the crime scene at the place of his alibi at the same time, or a bus driver that tells jurors their names are printed in a local newspaper. These cases that address extraneous information are clearly different from the case we're dealing with here. The cases I just cited involve jurors that go outside of the jury room, outside of their personal base of knowledge, be it expertise or otherwise, and gather information in an independent investigation and bring that information back to the jury room. That's extraneous information.
Would it make a difference then, Mr. Bosch, if the juror involved here was not a judge and the juror went outside the jury room to an internet site that had information about normal or usual sentences imposed on the type of conviction for which this defendant was convicted?
Well, I think it would make a difference, Your Honor, and it's the same difference.
Why? Go ahead.
A doctor in a jury deliberation can say something to the effect that a vaccine is administered by a shot, or an English professor can quote Shakespeare. That's different from somebody going back home and finding this information on their own that they didn't have before, finding this information as a way to inform themselves or change their opinion or validify their opinion about the decision they're going to come to. So I think that it would make a difference, Your Honor. But that's not the situation we have here. This is information that and I'll refer to him as Jurgi because that's the role in which he was serving on the day in question. His background and belief, which he brought to bear on the deliberations, as the Colorado Supreme Court and People v. Harlan says is to be expected. I have a feeling I cut you off, Judge Terry, if you wanted to ask a question.
Well, Mr. Bosch, isn't it a little bit different when you have someone with legal expertise in the jury room as opposed to someone that has other types of expertise, for example, medical and a medical malpractice? Because and it happens quite frequently, in fact, that lawyers sit on juries and judges do occasionally sit on juries as well. But if you have a lawyer or a judge with a photographic memory, who could not only say what the possible sentences were, but in fact recite the sentencing statute, for example. Isn't that just like looking something up in a law book?
Well, I don't think it is, Your Honor. This is information that the juror comes to the jury room with, and I agree that it adds an interesting twist because the specialized knowledge happens to be akin to what's going on at trial in the sense that they're both related to law. But outside of that interesting twist, there's really no difference. And because a jury is presumed to follow the instructions of the court, and what absent evidence to the otherwise, we have to presume that they did. There's really no reason to believe that the jurors would allow any statement he might have made, which is totally hypothetical and speculative in this case, to influence their decision.
Yeah, Mr. Bosk, why shouldn't there just be a hearing here? Why shouldn't the, let's get a record on this. I mean, the only thing we have here is one statement, and I guess one approach to that would be to say, well, with nothing more, hearing's not warranted, or the other approach to it would be to say, given that this exists, that this information exists, let's have a hearing and find out more.
It's a good question, Your Honor. I think that the statement, the affidavit makes it very clear that this question was asked once, and it was asked once after the jury reached a verdict. These people sit together in a room and they discuss the case. It doesn't make sense to speculate about whether some other juror had asked Juror G the same question or a related question, and whether Juror G had pontificated or given an answer about possible sentencing. If that had been the case, it wouldn't have made sense for this juror that's discussed in the affidavit to later ask the exact same question.
What's the standard of review here? What decision are we reviewing?
You are, this court is reviewing the trial court's decision not to review the affidavit.
Okay, and what's the standard of review on that?
I believe it's de novo, Your Honor. I apologize. Would you mind if I grab a drink real quick?
Yeah, great.
Very quickly.
Thank you. I mean, certainly to the extent that he's interpreted Rule 606, and there's an assertion that he misinterpreted it, we would review his interpretation of 606 de novo.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. You would look at, he was informed about the contents of the affidavit at the motion by the defense counsel, and so he presumably knew what the affidavit said if he didn't actually look at it himself, or herself rather, I'm sorry. And so based on his knowledge or his understanding that it had occurred during deliberations, she made, we submit the appropriate determination that it was not appropriate to consider the affidavit under 606.
So let's say we disagreed with that. Let's say we concluded that this was extraneous information given by the juror, and the judge did not look at the affidavit. Can we conclude that there's no error here, or do we have to say, you know, under those circumstances, the judge needs to look at that affidavit and make a decision?
Well, in my opinion, Your Honor, I think we'd go back to the chronology of the statements in the affidavit. A verdict was reached, the question was asked afterwards. Because of this, there's no reasonable possibility that the verdict was tainted by the statement. And for this reason, any argument otherwise is pure speculation. I mean, any time a jury reaches a verdict, we can speculate about something that might have been asked during deliberations, but here there's just absolutely no evidence in the affidavit or in the record or otherwise to suggest that anything else was said with respect to possible sentencing. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
I see that I have 5 minutes left, so I'd like to address the ineffective assistance of counsel claim unless there are other questions related to the first issue. As this court well knows, in order to prevail on ineffective assistance claim, the performance must be deficient and prejudicial. A trial court must grant a challenge for cause if a prospective juror manifests bias or acknowledges a previously formed or expressed opinion regarding guilt. Juror Galchinsky expressed neither of these things. What he did talk about were, for example, the following. He said, I'm going to listen to the trial court's instructions and apply those instructions to the facts. He explained a prosecutor's burden of proof, and he talked about how he judges credibility, and that he understands witnesses can get a little nervous when they get onto the stand. He said, quote, I'm going to keep an open mind throughout until all the testimony is received and we're in the deliberating room. He said that he understands that a judge decides punishment, not the jury, and he placed a lot of emphasis on due process. He said due process is very important. It's important to keep an open mind and listen to both sides throughout the trial. If anything, he elaborated on legal concepts that are meant to protect the defendant's rights, but there is nothing in the record that suggests he had a bias or a previously formed opinion about the defendant's guilt. So with respect to those facts that we have, I submit that it would have been improper to grant a challenge for cause under these circumstances. And the fact that his statements were as neutral as they were, I think, explains why neither the DA, nor the defense counsel, nor the presiding judge had any issue with what was being said, why neither the DA nor defense counsel challenged Juror Galchinsky for cause or preemptively. The defendant asserts that Juror G was allowed to pontificate at length about legal standards. It may be debatable whether this was a good idea, but the solution to this and the tool that the defendant had in this case was to challenge. And I submit that the defense attorney didn't challenge because there was no reason to, because there was no concern about what Juror G was saying. And briefly, I agree with Judge Hawthorne that there's really no way to fit the facts of this case into Canon 2B. It's just not applicable. The last section of 2B that I assume defendant is referring to states that a judge shouldn't convey or permit others to convey the impression that he's in a special position to influence him. But again, nothing in the record suggests that the questions or the jurors' responses suggested that Juror Galchinsky was in a special position to influence the prosecutor in this case. There's nothing there. And with respect to the last argument that at a minimum, Juror Galchinsky's status as a sitting judge shouldn't have been brought to the attention of the other jurors, no case law to support that. And the statute 1371-104, which says that a person should not be kept from a jury because of his or her occupation, says nothing about questioning a person with a legal education outside the presence of the jury. And I would submit that defense counsel was not ineffective in challenging for cause. And if there are no other questions, would ask the court to affirm the judgment of conviction, but also to deny the request for remand because it's simply not necessary in this case. I thank the court.
Thank you. Ms. Ruttenberg, you have just over a minute.
I think there's a fundamental difference between a doctor on a jury talking about vaccine administration and his experiences with that, than a sitting judge talking about sentencing schemes and how a defendant is sentenced because of the other instructions. The jury's instructed they're only to get their law from the presiding judge. Therefore, it's inappropriate and extraneous for a judge who's a jury member to also be telling the jury about what the law is. That's just not the same thing as explaining how a vaccine is administered. And, you know, the people state that we have to presume that the jury followed the instructions by the court, but we can't presume this in light of the fact that Juror G talked about the law in the jury room prior to the verdict being announced until we have a hearing where the defendant has the opportunity to question the jury members so we can place all of those remarks in context so that she at least has an opportunity to be able to prove that or make her burden of proof that a objective juror in that situation would have been influenced by those extraneous and improper remarks. And that's why there needs to be a remand in this case.
Are you suggesting on remand that a hearing be held at which all of the jurors would be called as witnesses to testify? You just said something about questioning, you need the right to, you need a hearing to question all the jurors, I believe you said.
I think it's clear from the affidavit that everybody was listening to Judge G, and I would want the opportunity to be able to subpoena all of those jury members and find out what they heard Judge G say, not only then, but earlier, if he was also talking about the law earlier.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That's all we have for this sitting of Division 6. The division now is adjourned until the next call.